I'll tell you, I am fired up today because how about them Bears?
Dan Wiederer
from the Chicago Tribune again.
Bears beat report and enterprise writer for the Chicago Tribune.
Your boy Dan Wiederer was on the radio last week with Speaks.
Mm-hmm. Co-host of the Take the North podcast.
We talked in London about Caleb being bossy.
He bossy, but in a not like mean way, but like his own way. So take that as you want.
I mean, does it please you? I mean, is it fondue?
It doesn't please me, but it's good to see.
We want it to be a fast Friday and a fast focus Friday.
Dan Wiederer.
His name is Dan Wiederer. Wiederer time.
Bears.
The Take the North pod. Dan Wiederer talks football with you.
It pleases us to no end to welcome Dan Wiederer to The Score. He joins us right now in this segment with Weedsy, is brought to you by Four Seasons Heating, Air Conditioning, Plumbing, and Electric. For all the right reasons, call 866-4-SEASONS. I'm pleased. Lawrence, are you pleased? I think so.
No, I'm not.
Oh, man.
I'm pleased that Weeds is with us. I'm not pleased at what's going on with the Bears. But I thoroughly enjoyed your piece about the purging that has to take place if the Bears are going to work through this. So when you were talking to people up there, what did you think was the most important part of them trying to get over what happened in Washington?
It's a difficult purge, Lawrence, to be certain. Like, this is a loss that left you with a lot of reflection, you know, and we've heard it happen in different ways, some encouraging, some not so much. And so I think what you felt collectively from inside that locker room is a group of hungry players driven to take control of their situation. That's how I would phrase it, you know, and Matt has given them the empowerment to do so. And they seem hell-bent this week on getting the steering wheel and saying, we're going to put this thing back on track. Now we'll see what the results are Sunday, because you know what happens for those 3 hours at State Farm Stadium on Sunday afternoon is going to dictate the entire tone of next week.
Well, that's fascinating. You could argue that they've been in control for a large part of the year with the offense in the first 15 and that thing. But a lot of that is narrative from what we've been able to see. Do you think now that they're going to lean into that this week and everything that's gone on, that the eight captains and others are going to lean into a sense of control? And what does that look like during a game?
Well, I think it just means, look, like, you can't supersede the coaches in a game. Like, they send in a play call, you run the play. If they want to take a timeout, they'll take a timeout. If they don't, they won't. And so you're not going to be able to have full control on game day. But I think what you've heard from players here is an understanding that you have to be focused on every single play of every single game. The Bears haven't earned the right to be prematurely celebrating as they did on Sunday. They have not earned the right to take an exhale with two plays left in the game and not defend the second to last play. You are a middle tier football team trying to get into the playoffs. That means on every single snap, you have to be locked in, understanding of your responsibilities, and able to do them at a high level. And so that's what I expect and hope that the Bears put forth on Sunday afternoon. But we'll see. Look, like, this is a very winnable game on paper, but the Bears haven't been great on the road. Your rookie quarterback hasn't been great on the road. You've got injuries on your offensive line. You've got some decimated areas of your defense that you need to shore up. And so you cannot get on that flight tomorrow and think, we're just going to kind of go through the motions and walk home at 5-3. No, every single play, you better be dialed in, because you better have learned that lesson last week on what can happen if you let up for one single play.
I'm trying to think of what the specifics of that might look like. TJ Edwards, perhaps more likely to call a timeout if he notices things are in chaos. Or Jalen Johnson or Kevin Byard, more likely to call out a player if they see him unfocused in a moment, instead of waiting and hoping the coach might do that. That kind of thing. Maybe it's happening more in practice like that. It sounds like it should, frankly.
Right, and I think that's like the biggest takeaway from last weekend is just how shocking that was, you know? And you better turn that shock into something productive, because I think it wasn't only the shock of the result or the shock of how the result happened. It was, whoa, did we really make those mistakes in those game defining moments in a season where we are trying to prove to the rest of the league that we are a team to be taken, for real, to be considered for real. And we did that in our first big stage game of the season. I mean, maybe second, because Houston was a prime timer in week two, but you had the stage and that was how you performed on the stage. And so now you better get it right. You better get back to business, and you better be focused in a lot of areas on Sunday to take care of an opponent that you are better than on paper, but they're 500 and they firmly believe that they can be in the playoffs too. So take them seriously and take every play of that game seriously.
I care about a lot of things. Obviously, like when it comes to content production that we do here on the Speed Going Home show, I care about that. I care about the type of access you guys have and the conversations that you have with players. I'm worried that because of what happened this past week, that all of us are going to suffer from that. Has there been any sign from what you've seen talking to guys in the locker room, whether it was on the record or off, where you feel like we're going to get a more vanilla version of details from Bears players?
Not as much as I expected there to be honest, Lawrence. I thought this would be almost an immediate chilling effect, and it hasn't been. I thought that the players who spoke on Wednesday were forthright and direct. I think some of them were candid in saying, man, I wish we wouldn't have shared quite as much to the media and kept some of it in-house. But then they all said, I don't regret it. I said what I said. I spoke what I felt. And so I think that there is a sense that they don't have a problem expressing what they feel as long as they deem it as justifiable and legitimate and not just an emotional outburst, right? Like sometimes you have a guy say something because he's caught in the emotions of things, and 2 days later he goes, that isn't really what I meant. It's just what I felt in that moment. This wasn't that. This was guys unpacking a devastating loss, coming to some conclusions and sharing them outwardly. And so I guess probably the true answer to your question, Lawrence, we'll see over the next 3 or 4 weeks as we get into different storylines and different plot lines as the season unfolds. But this week, I didn't feel like it was as shut down as I expected maybe it would be after some of the things we heard on Wednesday.
To the best that you can know, do you feel like the coaches are being accountable in private with the players? They're not doing it publicly. Mm-hmm. It's a different thing. Are they being accountable privately? I mean, and the side point is wondering whether the players need them to do it publicly. Frankly, Dave Wanstead said so yesterday with us. Lawrence, I thought that was fascinating, that he thought that the coach needed to do it after the game on Sunday because it has a life for 3 days on television shows that the players see. So does it matter to the players if they do it publicly, and do you think they're at least doing it privately?
Those are two layered questions, because I do think it matters what they say publicly. And I thought that Matt made a major misstep striking the tone he struck immediately after the game on Sunday. I thought that was a colossal mistake when you're leading the football team through a devastating moment in their season. Then he had an opportunity on a different radio station on Monday morning and again with the media on Monday afternoon to correct that. And he didn't. And I think players were like, well, wait a second, man. Like, you know, we're called out for every time we loaf on a running play, you know, and then you fail to call a timeout and fail to defend a play on the final drive of a game deciding moment. And you don't say that you regret that. You don't say that you take ownership of that. I think it did matter to the players. Now, I think you heard a little bit from Shane at the lectern on Thursday that gives you an idea that he shares some accountability when he meets with the players. At the same time, he didn't own up to the Doug Kramer play, and no one has owned up to calling that play, you know, 5 days after it was called, to the level where, you know, your offensive players are going, well, wait a second, if you make a play call like that in a key moment and we turn the ball over and we lose a game and you say I would do it all again because I'm being stubborn, I think that does matter. And so there's a test here, guys. There's a huge test for a football team that's trying to prove they're not the same old Bears, and they better pass it in these next 3 or 4 weeks. You guys know what's awaiting after the Cardinals and Patriots games. It's a division stretch over 12 days that's going to challenge them in massive ways. And if they're not ready for it, I mean, you've heard me before talk about lever losses. Somewhere in that 12-day span, there could be a lever loss that drops the bottom out of this entire thing.
It's so funny, Speaks, that you bring that up, though, because I had a conversation last year with a high-ranking team member, not the Bears, but a high-ranking team member. And this person had expressed to me that they were trying desperately to keep their players off of social media, but they knew that it was a losing battle. And they knew that after games were over, players were searching for validation in what they were getting from the public. And this person was concerned that the stuff that was coming from the team, or the stuff that they considered to be real, was not something that the players were really dealing with, that they were dealing with what was inside of their mentions, and this person was concerned that the team and the league wasn't ready for that yet, and what that might be about when it comes to accountability all the way around.
Yeah, I mean, it's human behavior, Dan. Right? It's the realistic nature of human behavior and the changing times. I wonder if we've ever seen a coach, you know, succeed with a disconnect like there seems to be, and that the answer is probably yes. Right? That the players can rally together for each other and play at a certain level that's extremely competitive and high, even if they don't think the coach has their back on some level.
Your worst case scenario is sort of like the 2013 Bears, who, you know, had a chance in the final game of the season to make the playoffs, even when so many people inside the building knew the whole thing was crumbling. You know, if they cover, if they stop one Packers fourth down play on that final drive, they're playing postseason football, and everyone in that locker room and in the building knew that the organization wasn't headed in the right direction. And so that was almost a situation where it's like, man, this group of you know, veteran leaders who were able to hold it together just enough, were talented enough to keep it together just enough to put you in possession to make the postseason. Well, guess what? That game was lost because they didn't pick up a fumble that was laying on the ground, and they didn't cover a guy on the final pivotal play of the game. And so, you know, suddenly the exposure of the cracks led to a loss that then took you down the path in 2014. Long way of saying that, like, that can happen for a while. You know, you can have a group of really good leaders and really good players that hold it together for a while, but eventually it's going to come down. And so when you identify some of these flaws and these weaknesses, you better correct them or determine that they're uncorrectable and move in a new direction, because that's going to be the decision that Ryan Poles is going to face at the end of the year if this season doesn't get corrected. And so there better be a very honest assessment of what's happening now and what's happening in the big picture over the course of the entire season.
You've been pretty vocal about how impressed you've been with Ryan Poles being able to step into some of those breaches that the Bears have had over the last couple of years. And I'm not expecting him to have a press conference this week, although I wouldn't be shocked if he pulled you guys aside in Arizona before the game on Sunday. I'm just wondering, has anyone made any contact with him? Was he visible at all this week? And should he have been?
There was no direct visibility. You know, has contact been made? Yes, in certain circles, there's been contact made. Not by me, but I do know folks that have spoken with them. It's more so letting some things play out a little bit, and then, you know, not overreacting to 1 week. Again, like, there's a very clear path here to get to 6-3 and set up a really big divisional game against the Packers at Soldier Field here. If they get back on that track and we're sitting here 2 weeks from now talking about that game, we're probably in a different place. But as I wrote this morning, like, that's a tightrope to get from here to there, and it's over a pretty treacherous canyon. You better be very careful about how you get from here to there, because otherwise you're going to tip off and you're going to fall down and you're never going to be seen again. And so, like, that's the state of this. But as it relates to Ryan, I think you don't want to overreact to one game, 1 week. You want to file it away in the back of your head, and you want to understand what the players were saying this week, you know, and he's got to listen to that with honest ears, you know, and let that sink in and try to understand exactly what is being communicated here so that he can do his assessment and his evaluations with a very grounded, emotion-free manner that addresses the situation that needs to be addressed.
I don't think it's going to happen. I picked the Bears, but what if they're 4-4 after a lackluster effort on Monday? What the hell does that look like and feel like next week?
I don't know. And it's very possible. I picked the Cardinals. I'm not confident in the pick, but you just need, the Bears need to earn your trust again, right? Like, they need to show you that they can respond to moments. Now, listen, like, after the three devastating losses of 2023, they came back the next week each time and won a football game. So they have that in their back pocket to say that, like we blew a lead against the Broncos, came back and won, blew a lead against the Lions, came back and won, blew that game in Cleveland, came back and won. So there is that sheet in the playbook that you can rely on to get you there. But Matt, I don't know what 4-4 feels like. I don't know what the tenor of the conversation is going to be. And as we always talk about, it's probably less about the result as it is the path to get to the result. Because I think a 18-15 loss to Washington last week on paper, if I had handed that to you on Friday afternoon, you'd have been like, okay, no big deal. It's the manner that that loss occurred that exposed a lot of things in this building that need to be addressed. And so I think a lot of it depends on what the path from the opening kickoff to the final gun really is on Sunday.
Dan, what do you like most to remember about Walter Payton?
Man, that's like my childhood. Like when you ask me that question, my gut instinct is my brother and I leaping over the chair in the living room, you know, with the football in our hands going over the top, you know. So that's the first thing, you know. My brother's 6 years older than me. That was his first favorite football player that he ever had. And so as soon as I was old enough to know what football was, it was my favorite player too. And there was obvious reasons for it. You think of some of the highlight reel runs where he just ran people over. I know my late father was always pounding into our head how amazing it was that a guy never missed work, right? Like you talk about life lessons that you can impart, like no matter how hurt you are, no matter how beat up you are, show up for the people that are beside you and who your teammates are. So that's, you know, without preparing an answer for that question, that's my gut reaction to thinking about that, because certainly I had a 34 jersey in my closet. And like I say, we would take the football and go over the top in the living room and try not to hit our heads on the marble table.
What a phenomenal answer that is off the cuff. Like you got a football soul there, Dan Weeder. I mean, there's a lot there. There's the visceral holding the ball above the head. And we all did over the top. It's funny. We used to play a game in college, me and my buddies, and we'd call it over the top. And there might have been, you know, some drinking, the smoking, whatever.
Perhaps.
But like the bed was the end zone. And like a couple of people would be the defensive linemen. And you'd try to go over the top. But none of us had the hops that Walter did. But that is 100% the image is like, I want to be that graceful and athletic and go over the top on these people.
You're right, to be able to leap and then look like a fish in midair, right? And then the land in the end zone and be like, yep, that's just what I do. I score touchdowns, yep. I flip the ball to the ref, and we're on to the next thing.
The way he would jackknife, too, like when he would jump over the top,
yes.
Was great.
Right.
Like it's like, oh, my God, like there's so many like great moments of like watching that guy. And I'm glad that we get the opportunity to kind of talk about all of this stuff, and you being someone who grew up loving Walter like Spiegs and I did. Is a lot of fun. Weeds, have fun. Be careful. Maybe I'll see you out here this weekend. Have a safe trip.
I got an early flight tomorrow, so it'll be a full day to soak in that Arizona sun tomorrow afternoon.
It's going to be a good time, sir. That is Dan Weederer. He does an incredible job of covering the Bears for the Chicago Tribune and does wonderful work with us on the Take the North podcast and, of course, here joining us every week. Speed, you want to talk about Walter Payton a little bit?
Yeah, man. You asked a great question in the thread. You asked Shane, like, of all the times that Jared has been on, in this slot or others, but I certainly, you know, was thinking about the times he's been on when I've had a chance to talk to him, what's the best stuff regarding Walter? And Shane picked what I would have picked. Just an all-time story from Jared about what it was like to be Walter's kid.
All right, so let's take a break and let's bring that to the people. And I want to share some stories too, because it's one of my favorite things that's on my resume. That's next here on The Score.
Spiegel and Holmes, afternoons on The Score.
Well, they call me Sweetness, and I like to dance. Running the ball is like Mickey Moe Mance. We had the goal since training camp to give Chicago a Super Bowl champ. We didn't come here look for trouble. We just come here to do the Super Bowl shot.
High formation, quick pitch to Walter, looking for the record, cuts back. He's got it. He's out of it at 25 to the 26-yard line. Walter Payton becomes the National Football League all-time leading rusher, surpassing Jim Brown. And that's the equivalent to Hank Aaron breaking Babe Ruth's all-time home run record. And listen to the standing ovation.
You better believe it. Best to ever do it. Walter Payton. It's been 25 years since the world lost Walter Payton. And it's... Jared put out a really beautiful post on social media earlier today. And it's... I tell you, man, like that dude was something else. He was really just an incredibly special and galvanizing human being. And that's a difficult thing to be. And watching him and how hard he worked. And honestly, to tell you the truth, the thing that I always thought was incredible about Walter as a player is it wasn't like he was a giant guy. Like he was on the smaller side even for his position.
In terms of height, right?
No, well, I mean, even poundage. I mean, he was just yoked. Like, the guy crazy, was just all muscle.
Crazy, crazy yoked. Like, you never... I did not get the impression that he was undersized unless I was looking at Earl Campbell or something like that. In terms of thickness, maybe because of the yoke nature of the man. But it's also like the legend was such, the indefatigable workouts, the stuff with the hill.
Yes.
You know, knowing what he was doing and then seeing what he was doing in terms of all the carries and all the work and all the yards on terrible teams, the percentage of the Bears offense that he was year after year after year. It was so clear that this was an unbelievably special athlete that was also getting the absolute most out of everything he had.
So when I started at the Score, I was mostly nightside. I was doing overnights. I was doing late night with Tommy Williams after I was done working with Les Grobstein. But then I got to work on the Walter Payton Show. I was the extra producer,
man,
who would come in for the Walter Payton Show. And for me, it was so surreal. You saw the poster? You saw that I had the Chicago Vice poster?
Yeah.
And then there I was in a studio with Walter Payton. And when Walter would... And this story is not just like a personal story for me. Like anyone who met him... He'd grab your hand and he just, you feel like how strong that guy was, and he'd goose you. Like every now and again, if he caught you slipping, he'd grab your leg and you'd be like, geez, like you end up with a Charlie horse. So it was so surreal to go into being in this business and being at this radio station. Like, oh my God, there's Walter Payton. And even if he doesn't know my name, he knows my face. Like that was wild to me. And then to be here as it became public that he was getting sick and being there in the studios for the show where Jiggs puts his arms around Walter as he's telling everyone that he's sick and that he's asking people to pray for him. It was devastating. Like, for as far as celebrity deaths go, that one was huge, but it was also a little bit personal.
Yeah.
Because by then, we had gotten to know him. You know, like, those of us who were working here had gotten to know, like, Walter Payton used to walk the hallways of our building on Belmont.
Yeah, man. It became a relationship for a lot of listeners. And I know there are a ton of listeners who are too young to even remember, you know, that era of Payton, but it came after another era of Ditka. So there, like, Ditka had a show, and then Payton had a show, and as listeners do, and if you're listening now, you know, you think you know us, right? You feel like you know us, or you feel like you know Olin Kreutz, who you hear a few times a week. I mean, that's what... A beautiful thing about this radio station is that along the way, you've had a chance to actually build relationships. They are relationships. They might be one-sided. For you, Lawrence, it was a little more two-way because you got to hang out with him and he knew who you were. But a ton of listeners came of age with an opportunity to actually get to know Walter Payton through this station. And that's a pretty remarkable and special thing.
It's also, you know, like I've known Jarrett since I think he was 12 or 13 years old. And like seeing the man that he has become has been really awesome because I think that he has embodied all of those things that he thinks that his father would have wanted, where he has gone on to be really good at the thing that he does. That he carries on the legacy, that he has not shunned the responsibility of being Walter Payton's son, that he's there every year at the Super Bowl giving away the Payton Award. And maybe the thing that I'd have to ask Jarrett, but I think maybe the thing that he would imagine his father would be proudest of is how good of a husband and dad that Jarrett has turned into. And the same thing for Brittany, your mother and wife, like how good their lives have turned out. It's amazing. It's a really special thing. And then for the time that Hamp and I did a show together, him telling stories about Walter and like augmenting what my childhood memories are with another one of my heroes sitting in the studio with me talking about sports.
Mm-hmm.
That death shook Chicago, and I think it still does. I think there is a generation of fans where those images and everything that went on leading up to Walter's death, like, absolutely shook us to our core.
Yeah, I think it's true. And I think the fact that there was a relationship with Walter as a listener and now a relationship with Jarrett as a listener is a great thing for our listeners. Happy to be a part of bringing it. We mentioned that we asked Shane what was the best Jarrett Payton story about growing up as Walter's son. And this is the one he thought of, and I could not agree more, from this show, I think, a year ago.
Get on the plane. We're heading to D.C., and I'm not looking where we're going. We're sitting first class. I'm like, I got my headphones on. They didn't tell me to turn it off.
So we just want to pause it real quick, because the beginning of it is that he came and picked up Jarrett in middle school. He came to his middle school in Barrington and said to the principal, I'm going to take Jarrett out. And they go to an airport and they get on a plane and Jarrett has no idea where they're going. All right, we'll pick it up.
Took off on, because I'm with my pops and I'm just sitting there. We end up getting to D.C. and we get our bags and there's a black car waiting outside for us. And like 20 minutes after that, we show up at the White House and sitting there. And then about 10 minutes after that, it's just my dad and I sitting in the Oval Office and we're just sitting there. And next thing you know, the door opens up and H.W. Bush comes out and he's like, Wally. And I'm just like, what? And he gives my dad this huge hug. He gives him a huge hug. He's like, you must be Jarrett. Let me take you around my house. So we start walking around the White House. He's showing me all the rooms. And then he looks at me. He's like, it's lunchtime. He goes, what do you want to eat for lunch? And I said, man, hot dogs and pancakes. And my dad looked at me with this side eye like, what are you doing? So they made me hot dogs and pancakes. Then we go outside. He's showing us the renovations that's going on in the White House. And then a little bit after that, we jump on Marine One and we go to a golf course and we're golfing. And it's somewhere in Baltimore. I don't know where it was, somewhere in Maryland. And it, next thing you know, it starts raining. So I'm driving around this golf cart. I'm like 11, 12 years old. I'm driving around this golf cart and it's raining out, Secret Service everywhere. And the president hits this ball on the side of this elevated green and he jumps into my cart and he says, young man, take me to my ball. So I'm driving him and I go and I get on the elevate, like on the side of the elevated green, and the cart starts to slip and the Secret Service jumps out and they grab the golf cart. My dad is trying not to yell at me, but he's giving me that look. And I get over by him. He goes, you are not driving anymore. No more. And the president looks at him and says, Wally, let him drive. So I didn't know who to think. You know, I'm talking about the leader of the free world or my pops, right? And my life was a movie.
I mean, the day starts at a middle school in Barrington. And it ends driving the president to his ball on the golf course. What the hell, man?
Man, that's so epic. And Jarrett's got, like, all the stories, man. And I'm glad that he is here to tell them. The stories of Jordan coming over to the house and Walter basically having to kick Jordan out of the house because Jordan just wants to keep trying to win his money back that he's lost to Walter Payton. Like, all of that stuff. And the player. And, like, his style.
Let's do that. Lawrence, let's pause for a second. Let's keep talking and let's take some calls. Let's call an audible.
I like this.
And because this is a beautiful thing, and I think we're getting some great texts from listeners who were affected by the death 25 years ago today in some of the ways you described, and some old school score listeners as well. So 312-644-6767. At the top of the hour here on 670 The Score, Olin Kreutz will break down the Bears and the Cardinals and more. But let's talk to you about Walter Payton on the Spiegel and Holmes Show.
Spiegel and Holmes.
If you're not listening to this show, then I don't know how you're hearing this. But if you're also not listening for other reasons, then you need to stop not listening, because this is a show you should be listening to.
Afternoons on The Score.
If that's not a promo, I don't know what is.
Spiegel and Holmes show, we pulled a little bit of an audible. We were going to still talk Bears, but we wanted to keep talking about Walter Payton just because, like, why not? Isn't this exactly what sports radio is supposed to be?
Exactly, man. Two guys who knew him, knew of him. You worked with him, but also dealing with a listenership that loved him on multiple levels and got to know him a little bit. You just start, before we take some calls, Lawrence, you just started to talk about him as a player. I mean, he worked so damn hard and did so much and had such little fanfare after success that it was just like, how do you not identify lovingly with that, especially in a city filled with people who work hard? It was just so easy to identify with and admire as well as be thrilled by at the same time.
There's no doubt, because it wasn't just the breakaway runs. It was the him putting his shoulder into someone's chest plate and dragging them for 10 yards.
Well, that's the thing. And it's like, if there was 3 yards to get, he'd get you 6. If there was 9 yards to get, he'd probably get you 20. And if there was 15 to get, damn straight he was getting you 60. You know what I mean? Because he had the speed to break away.
And if you didn't have a quarterback, he would also do that for you.
Yeah.
And those were some of my like favorite moments, like as a kid. He's like, oh my God, like Walter Payton's getting ready to play quarterback?
Yeah, man.
Oh my God, Walter Payton just threw a touchdown?
Totally. But it's also a different era when like people laughed at Franco Harris for running out of bounds and preserving his body and not, you know, giving himself an extra concussion or 9, you know? And we were thrilled and proud to have Walter, who initiated contact. And I still love running backs that initiate contact, man.
Before you go to the phones, let me just do the resume real quick.
Okay.
Because that's another thing that we sometimes don't do, okay? 1977 AP Offensive Player of the Year. Two-time MVP. Two-time NEA MVP, 1977 AP MVP, 1977 UPI NFC MVP, 1977 Pro Football Writers of America MVP. That 77 season for Walter Payton, he had 1,852 yards on the ground, 14 touchdowns. That also, he had a whole bunch of receiving yards for a scrimmage total of 21-21. In that season for him. Let me keep going real quick.
Mm-hmm.
Super Bowl champion, 9-time Pro Bowler, 5-time All-Pro, Hall of Fame, and the most important part, all in one uniform.
Yeah, that's a pretty incredible resume. Let's go to the phone lines. We're talking to you about Walter on the 25th anniversary of his passing. Spiegel and Holmes on the Score. Mike in Buffalo Grove, you're on the Score. What's up, Mike?
Hey, I have a short story to share with you about Walter.
Okay.
I grew up in the neighborhood he first moved to when he first signed with the Bears in Arlington Heights. And a buddy of mine lived right across the street from him. Got to know him real well. One day we're out playing just sandlot baseball. He shows up with Walter's moped. And I'm begging him to let me ride it. Let me ride it. He's like, I can't. It's Walter's. He finally relents, lets me ride it. Flying across the baseball field. And on this particular moped, the brakes were reversed. So I pulled the handbrake on the right to slow down. And it starts to slide. So I panicked and I pulled both brakes, which makes me wipe out. Thing flips over several times, bent the hell out of it.
Oh my God.
Was unrideable. The pedal was bent, and my friend's pissed at me. He's like, you know, that's Walter's. He's going to be so mad at me for letting you ride it. You're taking it back to him, and you got to tell him that you did it. You forcibly took it from me, and you did it. So I'm pushing it back to his house because it was unrideable. And I get there and ring his doorbell. He answers the door, and he's got this mean scowl on his face looking at his moped. And I tell him what I did. He's like, you did this? And I'm like, yeah, I'm so sorry. And then he flashes that big smile that he has, you know. And he's like, ah, don't worry about it. I got it for free. I'll get another one. He let me off the hook.
A phenomenal reaction. I mean, there's so many cool personal stories here. Let's just get some more. Bob is in Hoffman Estates. What's up, Bob? How are you? Welcome in.
Thanks for taking the call. This story is something that Jared told us. He was a speaker at a men's retreat at church for us. And this is, it amplifies who he really, truly is. He had told his kids right before Christmas, like a week before Christmas, he says, get in the car. We're going to Toys R Us. They went over to Toys R Us in Schaumburg. The place was closed just for Walter and his kids. They all each got a shopping cart. They could fill it with any toy they wanted. Jared ran around that store, taking everything off the shelves. He said, I don't even play tennis. I grabbed a tennis racket. And then when they're all done, they get everything in the car. They head down the street, and he's thinking, great, we're going to Portillo's. And they pass up Portillo's. He goes, where are we going now? And they stopped at a children's home. And Walter says, now, I want you to take out one special gift. And Jared's thinking, okay, I'm not giving him all the good stuff. I'll give him this stupid tennis racket. So he grabs the tennis racket. And then Walter says, all right, that's yours to keep. Everything else goes to the house.
Oh.
And Jared's like, oh, man, I got this tennis racket.
I don't even play tennis.
Yeah, that's exactly who Walter was. He always thought about the next guy.
Thanks, Bob. Appreciate that. Texters getting in here. Lawrence is talking about when they heard the news of Walter passing. One of the saddest times of my life. Don't think I've ever cried more than when I was watching his funeral at Soldier Field. Wow. Another one, Chris from Lake in the Hills. I'm a delivery driver for a large package delivery company. I was working when I heard the news. On my way back, I picked up two bouquets of roses, dropped them off at the house. Like, you know, having that kind of, that personal, visceral reaction and desire to engage.
It's a really weird thing to see someone that we associate with strength die. And honestly, like I thought it was an incredible moment, too, where you see Hamp in tears talking about how he's going to tell his children about Walter Payton. Another one of these really strong guys that gave you the vulnerability in that moment. Because I was texting with someone during the break, man, and I started tearing up because he was saying it's cool that, you know, you've known Jared for so long, and he asked about, like, working with Terry and working with Buffon, and, you know, my dad's still with us, but my dad would always, he was in awe of the fact that we got to work with Buffon. He's like, you work with Buffon?
Yeah, man.
Like, he's my favorite player. So, like, even thinking about that connection and what a lot of those Bears teams, and, like, my favorite picture is the picture of Doug and Walter. Have you seen it?
Yes. Yes.
That picture. The one. Connor, see if you can find it and so you can pull it up on Twitch, because it is the biggest baller picture of two of the best dudes ever just roaming the streets in Chicago.
It very much looks like a buddy cop movie.
Damn right it does.
Yeah, it's like, it's incredible. Well, wonderful stuff from you, the texters and the callers. We'll do this often on this show, you know, where we'll find something that's swimming around all of our heads and hearts, and we'll talk to you about it and engage. So thanks so much. We can talk to Olin Krutz about it. I mean, what kind of legend Walter has and how that is, you know,
lingered
over the Bears thing for a long time.
Olin's a Bear, like, right before Walter passes away. So we can ask him about the legacy and the toughness and all of those things, because he embodies that too.
Yep.
So it'll be great to talk with Olin about a lot of different things, and we will do so next here on The Score.